football on off the ball.
Halftime show, what was it, 27 minutes long?
Yeah.
That's shocking. That's absolutely shocking. The players should be the main focus here. I mean, it's a game of football we've all come to see. We haven't come to see the Muppets.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Right, well, it's the day after, the day before, and Ryan Fox, as I predicted, Dave McIntyre, won the Open Championship, much to the mirth and laughter of Gary Murphy, who is our resident golf professional. And Gary, unfortunately, can't be here. I don't need, know that he just didn't want to face me after I'd made the prediction that he scoffed. So taking his place is John Huggan. Happy to say, John, you're very welcome.
Nice to be here.
We kind of covered the first 3 days in great depth yesterday, notably Bryson's issues on Friday evening and then Rory's reaction to those issues on Saturday. There has been an update. There's been a further development, if Jeff Shackelford is to be believed. But we'll get to that in a moment. I think it's only fitting we start and talk about Ryan Fox, who has won the Open at the age of 39. So I'm looking at the stats here. The greatest 36-hole comeback by position in a major championship history, because he started Saturday in 52nd place before shooting the 62 that put him in prime position for yesterday's round. John, happy to see his name on the claret jug?
Yeah, he's not someone that I wouldn't have put a lot of money on Ryan Fox winning a major, but I'm happy to say, yes, I am pleased that he won. He's a lovely lad, and he's not exactly orthodox in this day and age of, you know, the game is becoming ever more scientific. He plays the game his own way. I mean, you look at his swing and you think, well, that's Ryan Fox. You know right away who it is. And I kind of like that. I mean, I'm kind of, you know, I like Shane Lowry for the same reason. So you can tell who it is from a distance. It's not just another 6'2" guy with a baseball cap on. Ryan, and he's a lovely lad. My limited experience of him is nothing but positive. He's a genuinely nice person, which in this day and age counts for something, I think.
Yeah, it was funny, actually. He was paired with Shane Lowry in round two of the Irish Open at the K Club, not the most recent one, the one before that. And I followed the two of them around. And I mean, Shane is by no means a slow player. Shane's a pretty tidy golfer. But oh my God, Ryan Fox is like, as soon as he gets the ball, he hits the ball and then he's moving on. And it felt like the two ball was just like moving at a pace and very, very kind of lack of long deliberation. I like his slightly across the line backswing. I do. I like everything about him. Dave, he, as I said, his weekend total is at 130. So it matched Ian Baker Finch's record for the lowest final 36 holes in a major championship. And I mean, all joking aside, I think Gary probably had it right that he mightn't have been top of mind when you're thinking of that bunched leaderboard, that he'd be the one that come through. But sure enough, he did.
Yeah, I've been primed all morning to speak to you guys about this final few holes of the Open and Ryan Fox. And look, we had a bit of a party in the house yesterday because we wanted to kind of mark what threatened potentially was going to be one of the greatest sporting days in live television in the history of the medium, between the All-Ireland Hurling Final and the final round of the Open and then the World Cup Final. Well, two of the three prongs of that were absolutely dour. Unfortunately, yeah. Limerick were just so bloody good that Galway never got into it, and the Argentinians did their best and pretty much destroyed the World Cup final. So Ryan Fox rode in on his great white steed to save the day. And it just goes to show, like, I know where you're going to go in a few minutes' time once we give Ryan Fox his flowers and when we're just discussing the DeChambeau thing with John Hogan. Like, when I read that this morning, I nearly threw up into my cornflakes. So. We're going to keep the suspense going a little bit longer for our listeners.
From the ridiculous to the even more ridiculous. But anyway, yeah.
Well, if you look at the four major winners this year, two of them are, anecdotally, I've never met them, the nicest guys on tour, in Aaron Rye and Ryan Fox. And it just shows you don't need to be a knob to be a winner. Nice guys can finish top. They can win the big events. nice guys like Paddy Carrington can rise to the very top of their profession and win the biggest tournaments that there are available to win. And that's what Ryan Fox has done. And we know how hard it is to win major championships. Just ask Tommy Fleetwood, like yet again positioned well yesterday. Sam Burns, Cam Young, although Young obviously made a brilliant run of it, but Burns and Fleetwood more so. Majors are bloody hard to win. And generally, you have to go and get them. And boy, did Ryan Fox go and get that Clara Jug yesterday. The way he played the last three holes, it was like a man who thought to himself, you know what, I may never be in this position again, and I'm simply not allowing this opportunity to pass me by. And we talk about slow play an awful lot on this podcast. 22 seconds between Sam Burns taking the ball out of the hole after his putt on 18 and Ryan Fox draining his. You can go through all of your rituals and your routines and your psychological mumbo jumbo and everything that these players do and the various different stances and putting routines and take 6 minutes to line up your putt. This guy just goes, you know what, I'm going to win this jug now. And he drains the putt. And it was an amazing moment. So happy for him. And he's a fitting way to end the major championship season. There they
Right.
are. That's me. That's me off and running.
It's and very, very good indeed. Let's break down. He birdied four of the final six holes from the 13th. I'll make the argument, John, that he didn't hit a poor shot. Even the bogey on 15, that was a very marginal miss. Finished in a fairly difficult position, and the but I thought the approach was really, really well executed. Nearly birdied the 17th, and then like that long iron just like ran into the bunker, and it was just magnificent stuff. And to Dave's point, as he said afterwards, it's not that Ryan Fox doesn't feel nerves. He hits the ball quickly so as not to let those nerves impact his play.
Yeah, he made the good point that, you know, that if you play at the speed that he plays at, there's no room for negative thoughts to creep in, or less room. But he and I and Rye, I thought, looking at the way they played their last six, seven holes when they won their majors, they've got more in common than their, you know, pleasant personalities. They were the only ones hitting all the right shots at just the right time. That's what they had in common. And as you say, even when Ryan made the bogey on 15, I mean, that was a hell of a bogey and hell of a smart second shot he played from a ridiculously bad lie. You can argue, I mean, he was thinking clearly that people who are feeling pressure don't do things like that. They have a go at, you know, when they shouldn't have a go. But he did everything right, and that was what he and Aaron Rye had in. Aaron Rye was the only one at Ronnemaic who was playing the course and hitting the shots that you would want to see the winner do towards the end. I mean, everybody else was making, you know, mistakes left and right. And Ryan Fox was the same yesterday. Even Cam Young, who came up one short. I mean, he took a five at the last. I mean, he was one shot ahead of Ryan Fox with one hole to play, if you like, and lost. So, you know, I mean, good on Ryan. I mean, I give him enormous credit for doing just about everything right over the last nine holes.
Absolutely. So on 18, he hit that lovely drive, misses the bunker, puts himself into a unbelievable position. I'm correct. I think he had 179 yards to the flag and took 9 iron. I'm like, I mean, that alone just deserves just a little wry smile. And what left it to 12 feet. And as Dave said, 22 seconds, like between Sam Burns taking the ball out of the hole and bang, just gets up. I mean, look, Cam Young barred the bogey on 18, which obviously proved costly, but Cam Young did everything right to put himself into a winning position. I mean, and there was that telling moment where he obviously had his break because there was what a couple of hours between him finishing and Fox finishing. Then he's out in the range, and did you see? I don't know if you caught the footage of him hitting drivers, and then he stops and he hears the cheer from the 18th, and with just that slightly kind of just crestfallen look, just puts the head cover back on the driver, puts it on, and just goes, right, well, that's it. It's a strange one. I don't know what you thought it is, and Dave, I totally take your point. It was of the three sporting events yesterday, the Open saved it because the other two felt like slightly bust. It was exciting, even though the lack of very, very high profile names at the very top of the leaderboard, bar Scheffler threatening for a little bit, kind of for some people might made it feel like it was a bit meh, but I thought it was super exciting yesterday because, like, literally, who'd have guessed?
It was gripping,
Yeah.
absolutely gripping. Ultimately, the best case scenario is you got three or four of the top highest profile names battling it out on the back nine of a major championship. And fortunately, we just don't get that very often,
No,
really.
we don't. That's true.
And we've often spoken in over the last few months about the leveling out in the standards. Like there are so many players in these fields that are capable of winning a major, and Aaron Rye has proven that, and Ryan Fox has proven that, and it's even a more wider, diverse array of types of characters and physical specimens that can win the Open, particularly when the course is as burnt out as it was this week, because length wasn't really the weapon that it
No.
would have been in other years. So anybody really, if they were able to find fairways and control their irons and get hot on the greens, which Fox was, I mean, his putting was out of this world for pretty much all 4 days, they were going to have a chance. And so it doesn't necessarily have to be, Scheffler duking it out with Rory or John Rahm or any of these guys. You were all in a position at some point over the last two, if not 3 days, to make a run at it. Like they'll all have regrets. I had a winning score of 14 under in my mind because I thought someone like Sam Burns or Ryan Fox would go out and shoot like a 65 because it felt when Cam Young was birding the first 3 holes that the course was there for the taking. But for there to be 362s in the tournament and the winning score to be 10 under par, it just shows the teeth that Birkdale had. Like one of the big other big winners outside of Ryan Fox is Royal Birkdale. Like for me, it's gone way up in my estimation of the Open Championship Rota. The changes they've made in 18, that's turned that into one of the great finishing holes in golf because you absolutely have to smoke your drive. And if you don't, you're in big trouble. And Fox's drive in 18, like, we'll talk about the drive that Cam Young hit at Sawgrass to win the Players' Championship. This was as good, if not better, than what he produced there. And are we surprised though? Like his dad was a killer. Like
Yeah,
this was in the family.
so let's. I mean, there's a couple of avenues there. Is John, before we get into his family, and you're right, obviously the son of Grant Fox, rugby champion, All Black, etc. But about Royal Birkdale, John, is that, like, if you were to just step in and go, oh, here, you've guys taken on par fours, and like trying to hit a 430-yard green, it feels as like, oh. The course is there for the taking, but it wasn't. And as Dave said, like 10 under is a winning score is more than a creditable tribute to the test that the golf course offered. And even though, like, they were like all the big hitters were all going for the par, that whatever it was, a 420 or 430 yard par four, they're all going for it. But, like, even still, if you were on the wrong side, like, it made your up and down like much, much trickier. So there was nothing, it gave you very little, I thought, as a golf course, but it was a very fair reward of quality, accurate play.
Yeah, you're right. The winning score is kind of the key. The RNA will be very, very happy
Yeah.
this morning with a winning score of 10 under. That's within the parameters, the range of what they would ideally like to see. And me too. I think that's just about the right for the winning score at a major championship level. But the things you just cited about driving greens and things, that had a lot to do with the weather that we've seen over the last few weeks. Had we had a wet spring, none of that would be
No.
talking. We'd be having a very different conversation this morning about how the course played. The pin positions are the thing that always amuse me these days. I mean, we touched on there about how difficult it is now to sort of stand out, if you like, at the top level, and it's never been harder to do that because the equipment is such that the average guy is so much closer to the best guy, closer than he's ever been. The other side of that coin, of course. Course is that relatively speaking, I mean the game's never going to be easy. It's a tough game, but it's easier than it's ever been for the top players with the talent level we're talking about. And you give them that equipment and you give them conditions like we saw this past week, then they're going to drive 400-yard par fours. I mean that's been predicted. Gary Player in particular has been sounding off about that for years. And I have to say that Ryan Fox is going to have to adjust a little bit when he goes to St Andrews next year to defend. He's not going to be able to play at that speed. that he's going to be incredibly frustrated if he tries to do it because it's going to take forever to get round there. Plus the pin positions, which I touched on there, the pin positions at St Andrews next year are going to be incredibly, borderline. They're going to be up almost in the bunkers, most of them, but to keep the score within reasonable, what many people would deem a reasonable range. So that's where we're headed at the top level. I don't know whether you like that. You can have different opinions on it. I mean, I don't particularly. I'd like to see, and it always makes me think of Tiger Woods and what he achieved at the top of his game at a time when the equipment was changing, the ball was going further. To do what he did at that time was absolutely extraordinary because it had never been harder to do what he did back then. I mean, if you give him the old equipment and the old balls, it's hard to imagine anybody else winning any tournament other than Tiger. He was so much better than everybody else. But that's not happening now.
On the subject of Ryan Fox's quick play. So, he's obviously a very, very quick player, but I was talking to someone who had gotten a message from David Howard, the amateur who missed the cut but had played Thursday, Friday, where he was saying that one of the biggest challenges he had was is that on average there was a 15-minute wait on each tee box. It's a major championship, and look, everyone has got their method, and everyone is whatever going about their business in a very deliberate manner, and it is what it is. But so Dave was saying that that was the thing. He was like, wow, you really have to reset. So what do you think it must be like? I mean, obviously Ryan Fox has been around for a long, long time. He's played a lot of tournaments. So, but for a quick player, it must be quite challenging to have that long a delay, or do you think that it's two different things?
Well, I think it's going to be worse next year, as I said, at St Andrews. I mean, St Andrews is by far the worst course for pace of play because of all the crisscrossing and double greens and all the rest of it. I remember Lanny Watkins talking about this years ago, and he was incredibly quick himself, and he had to make himself, the obvious things. He walked much slower. He would have a wee, almost meander to himself. Before he had to hit, because he was, if you go to your ball and stand there and wait, it's going to drive you crazy, if you're a quick player like he was. And he just had to find ways to fill in the time, basically. And I'm sure Ryan Fox already does that. I mean, there's no way that he could play at his natural speed in regular tournaments. I mean, as you look at, was it 5 hours, 40 minutes, and all that kind of nonsense they're taking to go around a golf course? I mean, and I saw Monty, of course. Monty was sounding off about the pace of play last week. I saw him on social media, and he again was very quick. I mean, I'm not sure what he did. He probably had something to eat between shots. But you have to do something if you're a quick player. You've got to find a way to fill in the time.
Well, obviously, playing your round quickly and playing your shots quickly are two different things.
Yes, and you're right. They are. It's like once you address the ball, you play it quickly. You're not being super deliberate. But like, I can't imagine Ryan Fox is ever going to be put on the clock, I suppose. Just in terms of, so he's got 20 odd victories, and he's amassed them all over the world. He obviously he built his reputation on the DP World Tour, but he didn't really, Dave. He didn't take up golf seriously until he was 16. He was like torn between, is he going to play rugby? Is he going to play cricket? Is he going to play golf? He, an all-round sports person, and clearly the son of a World Cup winning All Black. So, there's pedigree there. Like it's a very unlikely path to golfing superstardom.
It is, and again, it's another comparison with Aaron Rye as well. Like they've both come from very unconventional backgrounds when it comes to their rise to the top of the game, and it's just another example of the there is still so much space for diversity and different contrasting stories. Yes, you're going to have the brilliant collegiate player who's been destined for stardom since he was first handed a golf club McIlroy style at the age of three by his mother or his father. And you're going to have the guy who was still playing in amateur events at the age of 18 and like desperate to get onto the New Zealand national amateur team. And it was only a few years into his 20s then that he decided that it was time to turn pro. So he'd always said he always wanted to be a professional sportsman and obviously wanted to follow in his father's footsteps. He probably grew up thinking of playing for the All Blacks. But for him to go around almost similar to Koepka in a way to, start a little late in the game and then having to go around the various tours and win in different parts of the world and basically climb the greasy rungs of the golfing ladder and move up that pyramid. This was his third win on the PGA Tour, but he isn't going to be a prolific winner at any stage.
No.
Everything about him is redeeming, I think. We've talked about the speed of play. We've spoken about his background and his very different route to the top. The way he swings the golf club is so relatable. Like, there's loads of lads that you'd knock head down on your Thursday open in the local golf club, seeing swing him swinging the golf club like Ryan Fox. His putting stroke is not one that you would ever teach anybody. Totally relatable. He's clearly not like a gym buddy. He's not in doing his 3 hours of weights and 5K runs before he heads out onto the golf course. Again, another relatable thing about him, he smiles, he's affable, gets on with things. Like, the way the crowd were cheering for him down the back nine, it was like he was, a local boy like Tommy Fleetwood was. All of that allows you to buy in and root for him. And I'll be rooting for him next time I see him play. I'll be like, I love this guy. I want to see more of this guy making the headlines, stealing the stories from the big names who frankly are starting to kind of grind my gears a little.
Go on, why?
The big names, because
Yeah.
they're just mouthy. And they're like, look, take Rory, for example, my favorite golfer and has been for nigh on 2 decades now. No player I like watching more than him. He's going to be remembered for what he had to say about Bryson for this Open. That's what we'll remember Birkdale 2026 for, as regards Rory McIlroy. Not because he played great golf, but because he told the world how much he disliked Bryson. He was the only player that spoke in those terms about DeChambeau. Now, another person might say, at least McIlroy was brave enough to voice his thoughts and speak his mind, and isn't that what we're always clamoring for? And that is that there is truth in that as well. So I've been taking two contradictory pieces on
Was it
that.
not part of a bigger thing, John, though, with Rory? Like, he was asked, he gave some very forthright opinions about the FedEx Cup, didn't seem to kind of float his boat. He didn't care that much about it. He made it very clear that the compressed nature of the majors made the rest of the season less interesting for him. And that's obviously not what the PGA Tour want to hear. He made it very, very clear that his priorities had shifted since winning the Grand Slam, that other things seem to matter more now, or maybe not more, but have taken greater importance in his thinking. Like, on the one hand, you commend him for being interesting and honest, but on the other hand, he seems checked out, might seem like an over exaggeration, but like as if someone who's kind of going, yeah, I don't really care that much.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think we should be, Dave touched on it, but I think we should be careful what we wish for with Rory. If he starts getting too much grief for making an honest attempt to answer questions and just stops doing that, we're going to be stuck. He's going to be just like everybody else, which is not what we want as journalists, I'm sure. But I had a one-on-one chat with him at the Scottish Open the week before last. I went there specifically to try and get some time with him, and I did, just to talk about the Australian Open, because I do things for Australian magazine. And he said, I mean, I'm maybe giving him too much credit, and you've got to be careful with this, but I think he's very aware of his role in golf now. I mean, he's by far the biggest attraction. No one would dispute that. And he's willing to go to places like Australia and India. Now, I'm sure he's being well compensated. There is no, obviously, he's going to get paid to go, but he doesn't have to go. Scottie Scheffler doesn't go. And Rory, I think, he's at a stage in his life and his career where there's nothing left for him to achieve. There's little bits and pieces, winning an Open at St Andrews, passing Monty's record on the DP World Tour for, Race to Dubai wins, that kind of stuff. But they're little trinkets compared with what he's already done. And I think he's looking around to give something back. And as I say, I don't really give him too much credit for that. But he's doing it. The fact is, he's doing it. And nobody else is. And he's by, I mean, I was at the Australian Open last year. I've talked about this before on here, I think. The place was moving with kids. And it was the same when he played in the South African Open a few years ago as a favour to Ernie. The kids were everywhere just because Rory McIlroy was there. He's like the Pied Piper. So again, I mean, I take on board what Dave said. I mean, it's hard to disagree with anything he said there, but let's be careful with Rory. I mean, let's not put him in a position where he thinks, ah, to hell with it, I'm not going to answer the questions anymore, because he's got things to say. And he reflected, with the best will in the world, he reflected a very wide-held view of Bryson on the tour. I mean, Bryson is he's a long, long way from being popular. You know, not many people like Bryson DeChambeau. I mean, even Scottie Scheffler's defense of him on the incident last week was specific to, well, I don't think he did it deliberately. He didn't actually, Scheffler didn't defend him on whether he did it or not. He definitely did it, what he did. But only Bryson knows whether he knew what he was doing or not. But that the players were very careful to defend him just on that point and not on the wider issue of, you know, was he cheating? So.
I mean, there's no doubt. I don't know, Dave. I'm sure you're the same as me. But every time I hear Rory open his mouth, my overriding thought is I would love, love, love more than anything else to get him for an hour in studio and just shoot the shit. Like, just talk about whatever. Like, I never think that about any other golfer. I mean, maybe Tiger Woods, like, but in a very open conversation. But Rory, every time he opens his mouth, now particularly, I'm like, oh my God, I'd love to dig into that. I'd love to ask him more about that thing he's talking about, because he is saying very, very interesting things. Now, you and I, we discussed this yesterday with Shane and Gary. I was surprised that he went 2 feet in on Bryson. I genuinely thought like, obviously there's no love lost there, and like, I mean, as the kids say, he has zero fucks to give about, you know. But at the same time, I'm with John. I have to say, is this like, Jesus, thank God, like, in a world where everyone just says really bland stuff, like, good old
Yeah, no,
Rory.
like John, when John uses the phrase, you know, be careful what you wish for, I'm totally on board with that. I don't want Rory to change at all. But I don't want him to go down a road where he's more of a mouthpiece than, you
Well, that's true.
know, a top level contender. What he's done in the last 2 years, winning back to back green jackets, is just astounding. And obviously, one of them meant that he was the Grand Slam winner as well. And if he hadn't won at Augusta this year, it would be a really poor season. Like a really poor season. And I want, because I love watching him play so much, you want him in contention. And I want him to be maybe offering these quotes after he's shot 64 and propelled himself right back into the mix. But this was a week where he never got it going. Like,
He missed so many putts, or he
I
missed.
didn't see him hole a putt in 4 days.
Yeah, and like
Yeah.
ultimately, Scheffler had a similar problem. But whereas with Scheffler, just battled and seemed. Look, Scheffler finished on what, seven? So three back. Rory just finished down the field somewhat. But I thought his general play was good enough to put him in contention, particularly Thursday, Friday. But then just not making putts, it felt like the wind went out of his sails a little bit. And it was all a bit meh for, you know, one of the great, great, great players. I want to, before we get into more, so because there's plenty to discuss, like, can we just talk about Cam Young? And we mentioned it very briefly. Final round 64, three early birdies, front nine 29, the birdie at 17 to get to 10. He was just one stroke shy of Stenson's 63 at Troon in 2016, which is the lowest final round score by a player who to contend in open history. Look, found the fairway bunker in 18, couple of mistakes, ended up in the bogey, but surely this is a guy, he's there, he's good, he's very, very good. No?
Yeah, well, I Cam Young was funny this past week. I went from on Friday night, he was my tip to win. And then he played horribly on the especially the back nine on Saturday. So he went from being my tip 24 hours later, I wasn't even thinking about him. And then 24 hours again after that, he was right back where he was.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously with hindsight, I mean, he took 40, I think, on the back nine on the third round. That's where he lost it. It wasn't nothing. It was, you know, you could, it all adds up to the same score, but 72 holes. But he lost it on Saturday afternoon. It's hard to shoot a 40 on any nine and win any major, even one where the scoring's quite high. So, But yeah, I like him. I must admit, I like the way he plays. But he's another example of what we were just talking about. He's not got anything to say. I've never heard Cam Young say anything interesting in my life. I
No.
mean, he's not, don't make him a bad person or it's just he's got nothing much to say on any subject. And the thing about Rory is, I mean, before we move off him, Rory just loves to talk about golf. He's a golf nerd. I once did a long ago podcast with my pal Lawrence Donegan, who I'm sure is well familiar to you guys.
Oh, yeah.
And this was in Dubai. I was watching Rory play in Dubai at the end of the season, and there was a weight on the tee, which again we've touched on. And I'm just standing there, and Rory comes across and he goes, I've been listening to you get your podcast. Do you think I could come on? To which I responded, well, let me think about it. I'll see if we can. We'll get back to you. But we're joking. But he came on and he got himself into trouble again because he talked about playing golf with Donald Trump on that podcast.
All right.
Well, this was a few years ago now, but
Yeah.
that's the kind of guy
Geez,
Rory
they've all
is.
played golf with Donald Trump since then. Harry
Yeah,
Kane,
I
London.
know. Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
But I
come
mean,
on, Harry. Jeez.
who else does that? I mean,
Yeah.
no, Rory McIlroy comes across and asks to be on your podcast because he likes to talk about golf.
He hasn't asked to be. He told us once that he would give us an hour at some point. At some point in the
Yeah,
future.
good luck with
I'm
that.
still waiting. No, listen, Rory.
Yeah.
Rory, if you're listening, the invitation is always open. We would absolutely love to talk to you. Sam Burns, Dave, look, never found the lightning in his putter that he had for the first couple, the first few rounds. Didn't just couldn't get there. Proof that it's hard to win. He had a two-stroke lead. Yeah, I mean, anything can we say about Sam Burns other than he'll unquestionably win a major at some point? His game is good
Well,
enough.
I'm not going
Well,
that far.
no, maybe unquestionably is a bit strong.
Yeah, like he's only really been a major contender this year. So look, he's
Yeah.
still kind of a little green around the gills, and obviously he's played as well as anybody over the course of the four tournaments. He's come close twice out of the four, and one or two putts here or there, and one or two swings that he'd like to have back, and he could be US Open and Open Championship champion, but. He will have real regrets on this season when he looks back at it, but he'll also have taken an awful lot of experience and positives from it too. So it's just a question of how he builds on this and whether there is now scar tissue that will hinder him going forward, or whether he's now major championship battle hardened and is now going to find a way because he's been down this road and he will feel that once he finds himself in that position again, that he'll be able to draw on some of the experiences that he'd like to maybe have had prior knowledge of before Shinnecock or Royal Birkdale. But
Yeah.
to shoot two over yesterday, like there was nobody inside the top 10 that shot a worse round apart from Siwoo Kim, who joined him on 70. So as we said with Ryan Fox, these major championships just don't fall into your lap. You have to go and get them, and you have to be able to play well. You have to be able to play your good stuff on the Sunday. Yes, there's going to be errors in there. It's going to be a battle. As Fox proved, it's a real scrap to try and go out and win these things. And Sam Burns just hasn't got that just yet. Now, a couple of boat rolls of the ball at Shinnecock, and he could be in a playoff with Wyndham Clark, and he could be the US Open champion. You need a little bit of luck as well. And no, apart from his putting yesterday, none of the other elements of his game really stacked up. So it's just a question of how he bounces back. He's going to have an awful lot of time to think about it before he goes to Augusta National in April, but he has the game to win a major. But we have seen loads of players in the past who clearly have the game to win a major, the Montgomerys and Westwoods of this world, and never got it done.
Yeah, you're dead. Sorry,
Go on, go on, go
the
on, John.
you're dead right there. I mean, if he's not got doubts in his head at this point, he's not human. But I tell you where I felt most sorry for Sam Burns was at Oakmont last year when he got that. So he was royally screwed on that ruling that he got for the lateral water, the water on the fairway. I mean, they made him play this shot,
That's right.
and he when you hit the ball, there was mud. There was grass, there was water. I mean, it was an absolutely horrendous
Yeah.
ruling. I mean, in retrospect, I'm sure the USGA would regret that. I mean, that cost them at least two shots at a time when, if he gives them the drop out of the casual water, everything, if one thing changes, everything changes. So he very well could have won at Oakmont, barring that ruling.
Yeah.
And I tell you, I've always been quite impressed with Sam Burns. I think he does have the game to win, but as you say, there's no guarantees, far from it. But I watched him at the Ryder Cup in Italy on the Sunday afternoon. He played Rory in the singles, and I was writing about that game, so I watched a fair bit of that game, and Rory played great. I mean, Rory played the brilliant round of golf and won, I think, quite comfortably 3-2. But I tell you what, Rory had to play great. Sam Burns was really, really good that day, and he would have beaten most people. It took a Rory McIlroy playing almost at its top level to beat him. And I thought, well, this guy's one to watch. And I think you can take a view that he's got doubts, might never happen, but you can also take the view that, man, this has convinced me that I can do this if that's what he should be thinking.
Yeah.
You know, he's got the game to do it. And it's like Padraig Harrington was the same. He had a few failures at that level before he won. And it was one of those failures that actually convinced him that he could win at major championship level. So that's what Sam Burns needs to take a leaf out of Padraig's and just listen to what Padraig said then and go with it.
Tommy Fleetwood probably needs to do some lesson taking of his own. Like, he's the only player in the field to break par in every round. Okay, that's had a final round 68, which kept him right kind of there, but it's the bogeys on 10 and 11 that really ultimately killed him. Look, he was the local favourite. He talked himself about the pressures, the dreams of winning the Open since he was a little kid. He was playing in front of a hugely partisan home crowd. On Saturday evening, he talked himself out of contention. We pondered yesterday whether it was to take the pressure off himself or because he honestly believed that he just needed a lot of people to do a lot of things ahead of him to really give him a chance. But, like in my WhatsApp group, a couple mused sadly that maybe Tommy lacks the steel to get it done. Dave,
I
you're
think
nodding your head.
I think yesterday was a sign that it's not going to happen for Tommy. He did get himself into contention. He played brilliantly for the first 8 holes. He was 3 under par. He was right up towards the top of the leaderboard. And the rest of his round, the next 10 holes, were laid out there in front of him. Go get this now, Tommy. And I just thought he played scared. He didn't take the driver out of the bag as often as he should have. He was hitting some, driving irons off tees, which left him mid to long irons into greens, and very hard to hold your position when the ball is running as far as it is. And again, just another example of trying, hoping it'll happen without going out there and making it happen. The three bogeys, not at 9, 10, 11, and that's just an
Sorry,
absolute.
nine. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah.
And he only finishes. He shot under par on the final day. That's great and everything, but he was 3 under through 8 and played the next 10 holes and 1 over par. And he had chances. Again, he couldn't get a putt to drop, but he was leaving himself with 10, 15, 20 footers. It wasn't like he was giving himself genuine birdie opportunities. And it's again, it's particularly if you're chasing, it's not going to fall into your lap. You have to go and grab it. And we remember in Royal Port Rush, never put pressure on Lowry. Like, Larry really could have come a cropper that day if somebody was really breathing down his neck. But Shane never really found out what that felt like, particularly down the back nine, because Fleetwood just couldn't land any punches. And he didn't land any punches on the back nine yesterday. So my feeling would be that Tommy's major championship winning chances are receding rapidly
Wow.
in today's
Yeah,
odds.
I think what worries me most about Tommy Fleetwood and the number of times that he's put himself in position is that there's been a common theme pretty much every time, and that he stops making putts of any kind of putt down the stretch, and you're never going to win doing that. That is a formula for failure, absolutely 100% of the time. And that's what concerns me. It's not as if he's missing out in different ways. There's always that common theme. And he's got to find a way to make more putts when the pressure's at its most severe. I'm not sure how he does that. And you change something. I don't know. That's up to him. Only he knows that. But that to me is the thing that I see almost every time when he's in contention.
There comes a point where he just hits the wall on the greens and doesn't make a thing down the stretch. So he's never moving forward. At best, he's treading water, and most of the time, he's moving backwards.
Another guy who didn't make any putts is Scottie Scheffler, who, like, weirdly, like, if you were just an average player, like, you'd look at your major record this year and go, Jesus, that was amazing. Like, top finishes in most of the majors, but obviously he didn't win any. Make the argument strongest tee to green player in the field. Do you think? Oh, I know. I feel like every failure in air quotes that Scheffler that follows Scheffler. Do you think he's now at a point where there's a potential that scar tissue is setting in, or is this just look? He didn't have a year similar to the last 2 years, but look, he's still the elite golfer. He's still the world number one. He's still putting himself in contention. If Phil Kenyon and himself can sort out the putting issues, that he'll be back just dominating next year.
Well, sorry to go first, but the with Scheffler, I mean, I've said this many times over the years that consistency, I don't get consistency. I mean, this is the perfect example, as you just said, of somebody who's been incredibly consistent in the major championships this year, and what does he come away with? Nothing. And consistency is way overrated. What you want to do is do what Ryan Fox did yesterday, or what Aaron Rye did, or what Rory did with his short game at the Masters, or Wyndham Clark, who pops up every now and again and plays at that level. But he didn't do it all the time, and far from it. I mean, consistency, don't give me a, just give me a break about consistency. It's the most
Fair enough.
overrated nonsense in golf. I mean, who wants to be, if you finish seventh every week, nobody's going to know who the hell you are. But if you
True.
win five times and miss every other cut, everybody in the world will know who you are. So give me the home run hitter and not the guy who hits the bunts.
I mean, mind you, if you are finishing seventh every week, you're building yourself a 40,000
Well,
square foot house, and
yeah,
and
you're
you've
making
got
a
a
lot of
private
money, but that,
plane
but that's the end of it. Yeah, so.
and
But he can't get anything to drop. Like, he only had one three putt in the whole tournament, which shows, he's not far off, but like, he was so far down the rankings in shots gained putting. And I think he holds something like 240 feet of putts over the course of the 4 days. Like, Ryan Fox held 458 feet worth of putts, like, best in the field, and had only one more three putt than Scottie Scheffler, which was two. But before we move off Scheffler, Fionn, can we
Oh, we're
talk?
not moving off Scheffler.
I want to talk about the 17th.
Yes, well, obviously, this is what I wanted to lead to. Dave, do you want to take us through what happened on 17?
So Scotty hits his drive on 17, which is the par five. Obviously, it's a very scoreable hole. It's most memorable for what the shot that Porrick Harrington hit in 2008, which sealed the deal for his back-to-back major Open Championship. And his drive is pulled a little left, and he ends up behind a little bit of a mound. And he decides that, unlike maybe what we were discussing with Tommy just a moment ago, he decides that balls out, let's go for this. Pulls a 3-wood out of the bag. In fact, at one stage, he had a driver in his hand. And I was like, oh, this is going to be unbelievable. This is the sort of shot we all try and take on, the crazy hero shot when everybody knows watching it that you're going to totally screw it up. So he pulls the 3-wood out, and the ball, I think it might have clipped the top of the hill that he's trying to hit over as it went over, and it goes way left, so far left that he's actually gone beyond the hospitality and into an area, and this is the nub of the argument, into an area that was deemed to be temporary, immovable object. So,
No, is not the hospitality deemed a TIO?
yeah, that's what I mean. But
So it was
the whole
deemed to
area,
be behind it, but the ball is lost. They
the
can't
ball is
find the
lost.
ball.
So, but because they know it went in there, but obviously, if the members are playing this golf course in, September, on and all the grandstands and the scaffolding and the hospitality and the corporate tents are all gone, there's a good chance you might find your ball in where Scotty hit it. So the argument is, and the rule is, that I'm certain we're not hating on Scheffler here. He knew the rules, as he should do, inside out. This is not a Scotty Scheffler problem. This is a rules of golf problem. He's not forced to take a drop. He's not forced to take a drop in a penalty zone. There's nothing that penalizes Scheffler for spraying the ball miles left. And he knew that that area, and he admitted as much afterwards, that that area was a TIO, that if he was to really go for this and it was to go down that direction, that he was not going to pay a penalty of any description. And of course, he ends up making birdie, an absolutely outrageous birdie. But I'm so glad that the tournament wasn't decided by this, because it would have left a bad taste in the mouth. Like, I know this area of hospitality is not a permanent part of the golf course. So when the members hit there on any other time of the year, you may be able to go and find your ball. But when I'm playing golf, not that I get to play it very often, if I lose my ball is lost.
Yeah.
Like, a lost ball is a lost ball. They couldn't find it.
That was the gray area for me in this whole scenario that you've just described, was if Scheffler's hit the ball, his first shot, first attempt, into an area where you technically cannot lose your ball, he's not entitled to hit a provisional.
Why not?
Well, he should have been. If he hits a second ball, this is. I'm getting into areas that I'm not 100% sure of here. But if he hits what he deemed to be the provisional, that ball, if he's hit it into the first one into an area that where you cannot lose your ball in a technical sense, and he's going to get a drop, he doesn't need to hit a
Yeah,
provisional.
why did he hit the
He's not
ball?
entitled. Well, exactly. And if he does hit a provisional, that then to me should be the ball in play.
Once they realize that they can't find the first one.
Well, because he's in an area where you don't need to find it.
Yeah.
So if you cannot lose your ball in that area, which is true whether he finds the ball or not, in reality, if you can't lose it and he's hit a second ball, to me, that ball should be the one that he has to keep playing with.
Yeah. But to Dave's point, John, like, this isn't a Scheffler problem, it's a
No.
rules of golf problem. Because, look, it seems to me that the officials interpreted the rules of golf correctly. They did exactly what the rules say. But does this particular rule excessively reward players for, like, unbelievably errant shots?
Yeah, well, that's one of the compromises you make with all these hospitality units and grandstands and all the rest of it. I mean, even you go back to Vandeveld. I mean, he was just incredibly unlucky when he played the last hole at Coonstown. He was trying to hit his ball into the stand, and
That's
he would
right.
get a free drop, and it was a perfectly legitimate thing to do in those circumstances. But it's not golf in the true sense of the word, is it, really?
No. I mean, there are parallels that end once the ball is lost, but there are parallels with Jordan Spieth's errant shot at 13 that obviously triggered one of the greatest run of holes in Open Championship history. But, like, one of the interesting things in my very active WhatsApp group was is that it triggered again this debate that, oh, Scottie Scheffler is getting benign treatment on the part of officials,
No.
but Bryson DeChambeau is being harshly treated by officials because he's a live golfer, because nobody likes him, because he's unpopular, because he's, whatever. But now, I could be wrong here, but we're comparing apples and mechanical cranes here. Like, these are completely different things. They're not one and
Yeah.
the same at all.
No parallels at all.
No,
No.
Two instances.
absolutely not.
No.
And the rules are the rules, and Scheffler knew what the rules were, and the officials on the course knew what the rules were. But to spray the ball that wide and not pay any sort of a penalty, like, a compromise would be give him line of sight relief and penalise him one stroke.
Yeah.
And there's at least some penalty for hitting the ball as badly and as far left as he did. But he knew, no matter how far wide I spray this, I'm going to be fine. I'm going to get a drop. I'm going to get a free drop. And he could have won the tournament. And
Yeah.
it just would have been left a real bitter taste in the mouth. So I'm glad he didn't. But, fair play to him for knowing
Yeah.
the rules
Well, I
of
think
his
the
round.
problem I think that we're getting to is that the classification of the area that you hit into
Yeah.
is the problem, where it was, deemed to be a, area where you down under repair or whatever, but it was an area where he was going to get a free drop rather than just somewhere where, like a hazard, or where he hit the ball, you knew the ball had gone in. Like if you hit the ball on the beach, you played where it crossed into the hazard.
Yeah.
And that maybe where we're getting to is that it should have been a one shot penalty where, and he dropped his ball where it went into that area that where it disappeared.
Is there an argument for internal out of bounds, John, in these situations, or is that a bit too harsh?
Well, internal out of bounds is just an admission that your golf course isn't good enough. I mean, that it's just no, I wouldn't go that way. If they have to go that way, they've got a real issue, a real problem.
Yeah, right. So, I mentioned Bryson DeChambeau. We don't need to relitigate the incident that happened on the 5th on Friday. But look, he was 2 over yesterday, finished on 4 under. He had an ugly 7 on 11 that kind of paid, put paid to any chances he had of challenging for the lead. But then I was getting ready this morning for this podcast, and I saw that Jeff Shackelford had a story that during the 30-minute meeting that he had with R&A officials at the end of his round, that included them going back out to the fifth to have a look at the area that was deemed to be unnecessarily or needlessly trampled, that DeChambeau requested that Donald Trump be brought into the discussion regarding the two-shot penalty. Now, as we know, Bryson is a very open supporter of Donald Trump. They seem to be friends in as much as anybody can be friends with Donald Trump. When one of the more successful YouTube Break 50 episodes that he had featured Donald Trump, where it was very, very clear that Donald Trump was in absolute awe of this guy's driving and hitting prowess. So it's clear that, look, Trump is obviously a huge golf fan. He certainly knows more about golf than he knows about football. But I didn't think this story could get any madder until this
Well,
morning. Now, if Jeff Shackelford's sources are correct, and I've no reason to doubt him because he's usually very, very good, if indeed Bryson DeChambeau did ask the R&A officials, can we get President Trump on the line to adjudicate this? Like, all I can imagine is the R&A officials, very steely kind of stewards of the dignity of the game, suppressing the biggest laugh. Just going, you must be fucking kidding me.
apart from anything else, Donald Trump is golf's biggest cheat. I
Well,
mean,
yeah,
you're asking the game's biggest cheat to adjudicate on a matter of, on a ruling. Give me a break. Come on.
I mean, Dave, it's look, if it is true that, he could have maybe it might have said half in jest, listen, maybe we should get Donald Trump to adjudicate on this. Maybe Bryson wasn't being overly serious about it, but was just kind of, I don't know, whatever, like, trying anything. I mean, listen, when Tiger Woods was arrested for the DUI, the first phone call he made was to Donald Trump. And we see him on the phone going, hey, man. I mean, look, whatever. But like, it just, I don't know. As I said, I didn't think the story could get any more. I didn't think there was any legs in the story until I got up this morning.
Yeah, well, look, one of three things happened. Jeff's sources are wrong and it didn't happen. Bryson just quipped, like, when all this was going on, I mean, this guy gets his, he sticks his beak into everything, including, like, Balogun red cards. Anyone think we should get Donald Trump on the phone and see what he thinks of this? Or, like, because I know Trump was truth socialing about it at the time, so maybe that had kind of come into the ether as well. And Bryson's gone, sure, why don't we just give him a ring? Totally off the cuff, like taking the mick out of the situation, which would mean Bryson would go up in my estimation if that's what he did. But the third scenario was that he meant it. And when I read about the story, I just thought, oh, please, God, let this be true. And please let it have been a serious request on his part. Because if it is, it's just brilliant. It's a brilliant
It
story,
is a brilliant
development
story.
of this story. And if it did mean it, and hopefully he's at LIV this week. They're in Staffordshire in England, so he hasn't got too far to travel after the Open. I don't know if the reporters who follow the LIV tour are, do they ask genuine questions and try and put pressure in the golfers in any way that you might get at a regular golf tournament? Probably not. You're shaking your head, John, but
Yeah, no chance.
but I'd love someone to ask him. Look, firstly, was Donald Trump's name brought up in these discussions? And if so, was it by you? And if so, was it something that you were taking seriously? I'd love to find that out, because it does say an awful lot about him if he said, let's get the President of the United States on the phone to help adjudicate in this matter. And maybe I, if he did do that, my thoughts on what Rory had to say about him and on the Saturday would be softened. And
I
I
mean,
would
the whole thing's
play
just
Rory.
ridiculous. There's even a book been written about how Donald, I mean, I think it was called Commander in Cheat.
Yeah, that's right.
Rick Riley, formerly of Sports Illustrated, wrote about that. I mean, and there's chapter and verse on Donald Trump's attitude to the rule book.
Oh
I mean,
yeah, I mean, like, look, I mean, this is a guy who won his club championship like 30 whatever times. I mean, look, Kim Jong Il, like, was, you know, was slightly more embarrassed claiming, you know, 17 or 18 holes in one. Look, I think to kind of finish on Bryson, look, say what you want about Bryson, he's an absolutely superb golfer. He's a battler and he's a dog. But do you think that the incident, or was it just like it's just the vagaries of golf? He started off fairly kind of strong yesterday, as I said, the 7 on 11 to put pay to his chances. Like ultimately, it proved to be a distraction that he could ill afford, rather than, you know, I mean, certainly for golf journalists, it's, you know, it's catnip, but for everyone else, or certainly for Bryson, the whole incident is a kind of a, maybe unsavory is a bit strong, but certainly a re, you know.
Well, we're now getting to the danger of applying, what would be a normal reaction from a normal person. I mean, Bryson is a long, long way from normal.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the stuff that he comes out with, when I was at Golf Digest, we had people look at some of the scientific jargon stuff he was coming out with, and it was just gibberish.
Well, he doesn't
It
believe the
didn't
moon
mean,
landings happened, so you know,
no,
straight away I'm just
it
like,
didn't mean
Jesus
anything. And
Christ.
he's also, I mean, I had this is when he was still an amateur. And he played in Abu Dhabi a few years ago now, obviously. And I spoke to him after the round. It was just me standing there talking to him. And apart from Scott Hoke, the American golfer, Bryson is the only one who I've ever interviewed where I started to edge away from him. It was so bizarre. What it just so weird. I mean, it was starting to affect the way I was thinking. I mean, so I just had to get away from the guy. And I don't think he's changed too much over the years, some of the stuff he's come out with. So, I mean, I just can't take him seriously on any level on what he says. I mean, as you say, he's a brilliant golfer, clearly, but that doesn't make him worth listening to.
No,
But
that's fair.
on the his future, like there's no been no white smoke as to where he's going to be playing his golf next season. Rory, we've talked about his affiliation and allegiance to the PGA Tour, and he doesn't owe the PGA Tour anything. If anything, he is the single player most responsible for the saving of the PGA Tour after all the so-called superstars left for LIV and took the money and abandoned their principles. And McIlroy stayed put, and he was the torchbearer for the PGA Tour in that time. And he will obviously feel when he looks back on things that he was burned by the PGA Tour, the way they kind of pull the rug out from underneath him. So I'm not saying he needs to pay any heed to what the future of the PGA Tour looks like, but the other players do, and maybe that's one of the reasons someone like Scheffler didn't really stick the boot in, for example. It could be one of several reasons, but they need him back on the PGA Tour. There's absolutely no question about it. And he has said, when asked about the negotiations with LIV, and you know, where he said, I might just become a YouTube golfer, whether or not I return to the PGA Tour depends on whether they want me or not. Like, they have to want him.
They do want him. Of course they want him. They can't be seen to want
No,
him.
but do the players want him back? That's the thing. Not that the players have any say in the matter, but.
LIV, surely, look, whatever you think about LIV, LIV made everybody, like as Paul McGinley said this, LIV has made everybody wealthier in golf, including the players that never went to to LIV. They've all benefited from the existence of LIV because it drove prize funds up, and all of a sudden the PGA Tour have to put more money to keep their best players there. So look, in the end, like these guys, in the it's their accountant who'll tell them what they really think, I would
Yeah.
believe. So look, someone like Bryson has ultimately been very, very good for golf in the sense, and I totally agree with you, Dave. I think the PGA Tour desperately need him to be there.
Well, see, I'm not sure about that.
Go on.
I think that the if you were to ask the PGA Tour, do you want Bryson DeChambeau to come back? They would say yes, we would like him to come back. But do you need absolutely 100% need Bryson DeChambeau? I don't think so. I think he needs the PGA Tour far more than the PGA Tour needs him, because time passes, new
Well, that
players
is
emerge all
true.
the time. I mean, you give it another couple of years and there'll be more, we'll be talking about other star players we haven't heard of yet, and his star appeal, quality, whatever you want to call it, will diminish over time. And I don't think I think yes, they would want him. There's no question about that because, as you say, he's box office. But do they need him? Absolutely. I don't think they do. The PGA Tour, but he needs the PGA Tour. He needs somewhere to play. This
I think it's a mutually
next year.
beneficial relationship.
Yeah, I agree
Yeah,
with you.
yes, it would be. But I don't think they could live without him far more than he could live without them.
Right. Lads, we've hit the mark. So, John, thank you so much as always for your wonderful insights. Dave, thank you again for your insights as well. Sorry, I didn't want to
Thank
exclude
you.
you from the wonderful insights list.
Thoroughly enjoyable week. Amazing.
It was a very
Yes.
enjoyable week,
Well and
and
good.
well done, Ryan Fox.
Give us plenty to talk about, that's for
Yeah.
sure.
We'll have Nathan with Shane on the Ryan line on Thursday, so you can get your questions in on the Discord channel, or you can email golfweekly@offtheball.com. Yeah, we'll now, oh Jesus, now we've got, I guess, FedEx Cup, Walker
Oh,
Cup,
can't
Irish
wait.
Open to look forward to. Anyway, right, the majors is over. Let's all wear black for a week.
Hey
Lads, have a good week. We'll talk to you again next week.
boys.
Cheers.